Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Augustus Invictus. He is a candidate for U.S. Senate in the state of Florida. Augustus, it's great talking to you.
Sure, right back at you, man. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, can you tell us about yourself? You're a criminal defense attorney.
I am, yeah. I'm a criminal defense attorney here in Orlando, Florida. I own a law firm that I've had for going on 3 years now. I have 4 kids. They go to the schools here. That takes up most of my time, that and the campaign.
Did your experience as a lawyer, did that a lot of those experiences dealing with the criminal justice system inspire you to run for Senate?
Actually, I wanted to run for Senate before I ever became a lawyer. In fact, the entire reason I went to law school was so that I could go into politics, not so I could be a lawyer. I went into criminal defense because, well, on the one hand, that's what my father does, and I worked for him when I got out of law school. But on the other hand, I was in international law when I was in Chicago. And when I came back down south, I started working so that I could help people on a real level. But the entire reason I went and wanted to go into politics before any of that happened was that I worked at a pharmacy, and that pharmacy was shut down by the DEA, and I wanted to shut down the DEA for doing that.
Prior to running, have you been active in any other political organizations, political parties, or involved with other campaigns?
No, I have not been. The most I've done as far as my civic duty is being a writer and voting. This is a big campaign to start off with. We were actually going to run for House of Representatives until Marco Rubio decided to run for president. And then that left his seat wide open, which was actually a better opportunity. But no, I've never worked with any parties. I'm not usually a huge person to advocate for parties, considering the corruption inherent in those organizations. So, this has been a rude awakening. This whole campaign has been a steep learning curve and a very real learning experience.
What is your attitude towards the controversy? Do you see it as a good thing because it's bringing a lot of attention to your campaign?
Yeah, I do. You know, a lot of people were concerned about it at first, but I've always thought that it was a good thing because here in America, there's no such thing as bad press. That's very true. I think that a lot of people, when they see things like, you know, a white supremacist trying to start a civil war and, a Satan worshiper drinking blood, people see that, and a lot of people can see through it, and they know these are sensational headlines, and they look at what I've written, and they listen to my speeches, and they wouldn't be doing that were it not for the sensational headline. And once they do listen, then they say, oh, well, this guy isn't actually the Antichrist. Maybe he does have something legitimate to say. And I wouldn't have those listeners were it not for that scandal.
I know that the Libertarian chairman actually resigned because of your campaign.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Of the state of Florida.
He said that he wanted to stop me from running because once the media got a hold of me and my colorful background, the media would tear me apart and it would sink the Libertarian Party of Florida. And it seems funny that that was his justification for attacking me all those months, because when he resigned, he was the one to go to the media and make sure they knew about it, and he is the one who sank the LPF and caused the leadership to implode. So I don't know. I don't know if he had ulterior motives or what was going on there, but he certainly did resign because of me. I think that we can agree on.
Maybe he actually was supporting you, right?
Yeah, I know,
like,
right? A lot of people thought that he was my press agent because he did so well.
I'd like to introduce my co-host, Charles Lincoln, who just joined us.
Hey, Mr. Lincoln. Nice to meet you.
You're in Palm Beach Gardens?
I'm sorry?
You're in Palm Beach Gardens. I noticed that you're having a demonstration there on Military Trail. Sunday. Is that your base of operations?
No, sir. I am actually in downtown Orlando. We are leaving in the morning for West Palm Beach. I've got a Libertarian Party meeting to attend. I've got a lot of supporters I've got to meet with. And then Sunday is actually an event that is Justice for Corey Jones, the young man who was shot by a police officer who was not wearing a uniform.
A young man who I might say goes a long way to sort of really proving just what a white supremacist you are, right?
Corey Jones did happen to be black. So, this is not like a publicity stunt or anything. My whole point in making this statement is this has nothing to do with black and white, has nothing to do with race. We're all living in a police state. So it goes beyond those divisions.
So now, is it true that you both? I don't know what you all were obviously talking about some of the stuff in the press about you being lies. But is it true that you said that you're a fascist or a fascist sympathizer or something?
I think that comes from a YouTube video I have. So you'll see if you look me up, I've got two different YouTube accounts, and one of them is personal, and it's got poetry recitations and literature. Readings from the Odyssey, things like that. One of them is a whole series that I've done on Ezra Pound, and Ezra Pound was an out-and-out fascist, and after the war, he was treated rather badly by the Americans. So one of those recitations is his Salutation the Third, which is basically a big middle finger to everyone in the establishment, and that's where there is a comment on there where I said, "My fellow American fascist." And people jumped all over that and said that I'm a closet fascist, this, that, and the other, linked it to the campaign logo, and that's where that comes from.
He was also famous for speaking out against the whole, banking system.
Yes, he is. And actually, I'm going to have an event at the Jack Kerouac House here in Orlando on the 19th, and I plan on doing a recitation of his canto, the Usura canto, which is exactly about that.
So you're against usury. That's very interesting, because there is a segment of libertarians who think basically you should let the banks and corporations do whatever they want.
Right. And that's why I get a lot of heat from the libertarians in my own party. You know, I've never been one to take the writings of Ayn Rand or Rothbard or anybody else as holy scripture. That's never been my understanding of libertarianism. You know, my father raised me to be a libertarian, and it was more in the sense of classical liberalism, going back to roots, believing in the Constitution, what our forefathers said. So this whole obsession with these certain writers and this obsession with corporations, I've never understood that, and I get a lot of flack for that.
I would basically describe the libertarian establishment. They basically worship corporations, plus they also have, the worst characteristics of, social justice warriors when it comes to political correctness. They're just awful.
Well, that is true of a lot of people in the Libertarian Party, but I wouldn't say that's a general characteristic of libertarians. I mean, I consider myself a libertarian. I mean, I'm running as one, and a lot of my friends in the party, they share the same view as you and I. I think it's just been infiltrated by a lot of these social justice warriors. I wouldn't say corporations are all evil. I mean, I'm a business owner, and I'm very business friendly. But the thought that we should get rid of government because business owners are inherently noble, that's something I could never agree with. And that keeps me at odds with those that wing of the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, I mean, business serves a purpose, but I think it's important for there to be a balance of power. And there's abuses within government and within corporations. Basically, any institution that becomes too big can become corrupt and abuse its power.
Right.
So it needs to be the right balance between government and corporations. One concern is that if you remove all government regulation, then corporations will fill in that vacuum of the government and take over that power.
I always say, Robert, that that's a total misunderstanding of the reality. there can be no major corporations without government regulation. They are sustained by government regulation. They
right,
are promoted
that's also true.
By the income tax system and the Social Security system. If you take away all government regulations, you will basically go back to the way the United States was before 1860, which is why you invited me on this call. government regulations that sustain the corporate world, these corporations will fairly rapidly unravel.
Yeah, there's something to be said about subsidies being given by the government, especially to the larger things and to the agriculture.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen.
And also,
Amen.
It was pointed out to me by the anarchist, the infamous anarchist, Christopher Cantwell. He pointed out to me in private conversation once that were it not for government, corporations could not exist because corporate entities are only recognized by government. So if you did not have government, corporations as we understand them would not exist. And I thought that was a very interesting point that he made.
I mean, a corporation comes into existence via a governmental charter, and
right.
The very earliest corporations were like the Hudson Bay Company, the Virginia Company, the East India Company. They were basically acting as arms of the government anyhow.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't think you can put all the blame on government or on corporations. I think it's a human problem, you know. You said, Mr. Stark, that there's a concern that once an organization gets too big, it's going to corrupt. But I think even if you have a small organization, just take the family. You know, if the father is a drunkard or a man without principle or if the woman has no virtue, the family could very well become corrupt and fall apart, and it's no different than a government or a corporation. So I think any time you have humans in society, there's that danger that someone will abuse power or that someone will act in bad faith.
And it's also an issue with, like, the quality of the people and the culture of a society.
Right.
The values that
people
have.
I think culture, there's a lot to be said about culture.
One issue that has gotten you in trouble is you wrote an essay in college dealing with eugenics, and you kind of make a comparison like to the film Idiocracy, how people are becoming stupider and stupider.
Yeah, well, that part of the paper I still hold to. I think that's incontrovertible. We've got that sort of evidence. I mean, it's the policy aspect of the paper saying that we should sterilize people. That's what I've disavowed that. I don't believe that anymore. But the fact that we, the intelligent, the strong, are being breeded out, that I don't think that's even controversial. I think everyone sees that.
Exactly. I mean, tell us exactly how you think we're being bred out. I mean, I need to know the details of where you're coming from on that.
Sure. Well, if you look at the government policies, for instance, one of the things that I've pointed out is that the government, whether it's state or federal, whatever level you look at it, they have abandoned their eugenics program. And that's more a statement of virtue ethics than of legal principles. So I think when we did that, we said we don't care about being the strongest and the brightest and the best. We're just going to give up on that. We're not trying to create the Übermensch. We're just going to be average Joes. But with the policies the government has now, it's actually a dysgenics program. And we give out welfare. We give out these social programs. And it actually encourages people to be more and more dependent on government, to be less and less entrepreneurial. It encourages those values that that historically America was not in favor of. But it also, I mean, there's the more controversial point that the poorest and the dumbest, they are breeding, and they are breeding at much more rapid rates than the people of the upper class. Now, that might be offensive, but I think that's a fact.
Well, I think it is. I think it is a fact. I guess I have a tremendous problem with the whole concept of government-mandated eugenics, because the government,
right.
in
Me
my
too.
Opinion, can't really do anything right. And
exactly.
the idea that they could guide biological evolution is, you know, approaching preposterous. I think that, you know, what you're saying is that basically the natural order of things, the stupider, less clever people just tend to die out because they can't survive.
Right, but in our society, that's the opposite, I think, now.
So what do you hope to accomplish in your campaign? I mean, I assume you sort of have a fairly realistic idea of what your chances are of beating Marco Rubio.
Right.
Well,
Marco
Rubio
is not the concern.
He's retiring.
He's running for president, and he's out. So this is a wide-open race. There is no incumbent to worry about. But still, there is the problem of running against the Democratic and Republican machines. And as a third-party candidate, no Libertarian has ever won federal office in this country. So, it's definitely an uphill battle. Still, I don't go into things pessimistically. I'm usually an optimistic person, being an entrepreneur myself. So I like to think that there may be some miracle that allows us to get 33%, because that's really all we need. And with the way things are going, I think if there's ever been a year that Americans have been disillusioned with the two-party system, that would be the coming year.
Yeah, I mean, you just see it with the election. Like, whatever you think about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump as candidates, the fact that, like, so many people are voting for them is a sign of disillusionment with the system. I mean, people have been
right.
complaining a lot over the last decade, but they still ended up voting for the establishment appointed candidates.
Yeah, so I think even if the Democrats and Republicans in the state of Florida were to run anti-establishment candidates, I think people still would be a little wary of that. And it just happens to be the case that every single person that I know of that's running is a career politician. So I think I stand apart from the crowd in that aspect alone.
Do you have an open field on the Libertarian Party, or do you have a Libertarian challenger?
I have prospective challengers. They have been actively trying to recruit people to primary me because the leadership of the LPF does not like me. They have failed so far in that effort, and even if they did, the only person I could think of that would be a real challenge that is a prospective candidate would be Roger Stone, who is a GOP hitman, and I think Libertarians would be more wary of him than they are of me.
So you have a declaration of the failings of the federal government?
Right.
And I guess I'll go over some of the key points. There's a lot of different ones. You do talk about the issue of immigration, and you say the government has allowed unrestrained immigration for three generations to the detriment of the American people and of the land. Our forefathers came as conquerors. You say that the immigrants of today come as parasites.
I wrote that. Yeah, and that gets me a lot of trouble, you know, because that's very unapologetic and an abrasive way to say it, but it's a fact, you know. When our forefathers came here, America's a wilderness. Go ahead.
But what about Florida? I mean, what do you want to do with Florida? I mean, Florida is almost entirely an immigrant population. You're representing Florida. I mean, what do you say to the Cubans and Haitians in Florida? Are they all going to go?
No, I'm not. I get asked if I'm following Donald Trump's immigration policy, and I'm not. I think there are bigger problems here than immigration, and I'm not looking to build a wall or send ICE to deport everybody. But I am looking to basically close down immigration until we can sort out the problems in our country. As far as the Cubans and the Hispanic community, I don't think they want more and more and more Hispanics as much as the media is saying that they do. I think that the Cubans especially, they have assimilated into the American culture, and I think they would probably find it offensive that we can say, oh, well, you can come to America and just, you know, keep your Nicaraguan or Honduran culture and not assimilate into America. The Haitians, likewise, they're basically Americanized. I mean, maybe not down in South Florida, but you know, I have Haitian clients here in Central Florida, and they're very much American, and they don't hold any illusions that they're hyphenated or anything else. So I don't think it's as tough a sell as people think.
So you, so in fact, you do not have any particular, you do not have any particular feelings about race?
I mean, I'm unapologetic about being white, and I hate the whole fashion that it's cool to bash white people, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, you know, my kids, they're half Puerto Rican. I mean, my ex-wife's family is Hispanic, so I'm not, you know, this whole branding that I'm a white supremacist is false. But on the other hand, neither am I a cultural Marxist, and I don't believe in, you know, forcibly miscegenating the whole population so that we're all one, you know, homogenized race. I think that's just insane. I think that real racial diversity is allowing races to keep their identity. So I take a more nuanced approach, I guess, than most candidates, but it's still probably the most offensive approach there is.
But how does that play out in reality? I mean, what do you if you were to be, let's say, this miracle happened and you got 33-34% of the vote and the rest was split in plurality, and you won, what would you do as senator to change any of that?
I think the most important thing to do to change that is to change the culture, and that's a point I've been trying to make repeatedly throughout the campaign. And I've said in speeches and elsewhere that if you think electing one libertarian or any third-party candidate to office is going to save the world, if you think that's going to change America just because you elected someone, then you're dreaming. What you need to do is change the entire culture. Because even if you were to elect representatives that said this, that, or the other, if the American people don't believe it, it won't be true. So I think first and foremost, the problem is cultural. But secondarily, once I am elected, to answer your question, I think the first and foremost thing to do would be to destroy the Department of Education. I think that federal interference in education is probably one of the biggest problems we have. Immigration would be another one, but in that I would just be far more restrictive. Mr. Stark pointed out that there is a paragraph on the official platform on my website that sounds a lot more liberal, maybe not progressive, but certainly a lot less conservative than the Declaration.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, I wasn't trying to, I don't want to give you a hard time, but I got the impression that they sounded different. Like, one sounded much more liberal on immigration.
Right.
And you told
me
basically that you've gotten attacked for being, simultaneously, you've been called a racist and a fascist, but you've been also called a conservative.
Yeah, and I think that's the danger when you don't choose a camp. When you say, look, we do have a problem with immigration, but the solution is not building a wall. And we do have a problem with integration, but the solution is not sending ICE and spending billions of dollars on kicking everyone's door in and kicking out all the brown people. Like, there has to be a rational answer to this. And when you say that, you know, people don't listen because at that point, there's no argument. You know, you either believe in something or you don't. It's very much like a creed these days. You know, either you believe in progressivism or you believe in conservatism. And very rarely is there any middle ground. So, yeah, I've gotten flack from both sides for that.
And even as a libertarian, I brought this up at the beginning of the show, but you're sort of expected to take the Libertarian Party line 100%. Like, it's okay to take your own position on every issue. You don't have to follow an ideology like a religion.
Well, that's what I would like to think, you know, and that's part of the reason I like the Libertarian Party. I thought, well, I might not agree on their position on business versus the environment, and I might not agree on abortion because I'm personally anti-abortion, and I might not agree on immigration because I'm a conservative, I think, when it comes to immigration. But basically, I am in agreement on most issues with libertarians, and I consider myself a libertarian. So I would think this party of all parties, this should be the party where we are allowed to agree to disagree. We're allowed to have divergent opinions. But in practice, that does not seem to be the case. Libertarians very much want their candidates to tote the official line, speak the official platform, right on down the center. And it's no different than the Democratic or Republican parties in that respect, which is unfortunate.
One issue that is very important, that I guess is also an unconventional issue as a libertarian, is you talk about the importance of preserving wilderness. And obviously it's a big problem in California, but from what I've heard, Florida has just become a big disaster with suburban sprawl destroying the environment there.
That's very true. Yeah, here in Florida, we've got our problems just like any other state. You've got, on the one hand, you've got Coca-Cola buying up land, controlling our legislature to get these favorable deals, scooping up tap water from Jacksonville that they sell back to America as Dasani. Yeah, I mean, the corporations here, they're not exactly taking care of the environment. And with Rick Scott as governor, the environment's really taken a back seat, but still, Floridian, you know, on an individual level, we all care about the wildlife and the habitats and everything else. It's a business versus environment issue, and that's where I disagree with libertarians, that if you just sell everything, well, then the people who own the land, they'll protect it. I just don't believe that. I think the people who own the land will sell it, and the corporations will take it, and they will do what they want to do with it, because that's exactly what they do now. To think that would be any different because we don't have government control, I don't see how that's realistic.
Yeah, because the thing with their argument is they say people are always going to take care of their property.
Right.
The reality is if you privatize the national parks, you would see corporations come in and open up national parks to logging and mining. I think government does play a role in protecting the environment.
Do you think
especially the
corporations are not? I'm just going to interject myself here. Do you think that corporations are not exploiting the national park system already? I mean, national parks are huge tourist attractions, and just try reserving a place for Christmas or New Year's by the Grand Canyon. You're not, that is a competitive corporate market there.
Absolutely.
Everywhere. I mean, they know the value of tourism. They probably wouldn't log Yosemite if it were privatized. They might bring so many people and it would trample down all the trees, but certainly kill off all the wildlife. But it's happening anyhow. I mean, it's really happening under government management right now.
I agree. It is, and if you read wilderness or nature writings from, 50, 60 years ago, those people would be rolling over in their graves right now if this all was going on, especially the Grand Canyon. So what you said reminded me of that. There was a writer who was talking about, well, why do we need to have roads, a couple miles from the canyon? Why don't you, have it so that you have to camp on your walk in? And if you look at the Grand Canyon now, I mean, you can drive right up to the rim and walk down in there on pre-constructed paths, and it's just 60 years ago, that would have been science fiction. That would have been outrageous. And even with government oversight now, it's bad.
It's totally outrageous even today.
Yeah.
There are times when they actually have air pollution in the Grand Canyon. Measurable air pollution because there are so many cars and planes on the rim. It is a scandal what's going on.
It is.
And so it simply isn't true that privatizing is going to be all that much different from corporate. I mean, like the private prisons, for instance. The private prisons just managed to exacerbate the abuses of governmental prisons by making it even more confusing about who's really liable for what. The government corporate partnership, especially especially in law enforcement and but also in banking and real estate finance, it's basically a pass the buck kind of partnership where nobody is responsible for anything.
That's true. And you also look at how they nickel and dime the inmates. I mean, I hear stories from my clients about how they can't get a toothbrush, they can't make phone calls, nothing. They can do nothing without paying cash at the commissary, and their families are the ones paying for it. And the bills just, they're astronomical, you know, and there are prisons where they've got to pay for their own room and board. I mean, it's just, it's insane, and it's not government at all. That's privatization right there. So I don't know if that, if more of that is the answer. I think the answer would most likely be stop letting the corporations influence the government. If the government really were protecting the welfare of the people and not protecting private and special interests, maybe that's the answer to these things.
I know Florida in particular has a bad reputation for both police abuse and prisoner abuse.
Yeah, that's true, man. I mean, growing up, you know, like I said, my dad was a criminal defense attorney, and he would tell me just the wildest stories. You know, some kid sitting in his car, and a cop just walked up and tasered him in the face. Or a girl who was skinny dipping at a pool, and the cops tasered her while she was still wet when she got out of the pool. I mean, just, those things don't make the news,
that's
and they're so common down here that they'll never make the news.
Electricity and water can be deadly.
Yeah, I know, and you'd think the cops would know that too, but they don't care. You know, they have no accountability. No one holds them responsible for this, and people are terrified to go file complaints at the police stations because they think they're going to be retaliated against, especially in small towns like we have down here in Florida. There are only several towns here that are considered real cities, like Tampa and Orlando and Jacksonville and Miami. Everything else, I mean, we're pretty rural down here.
Does Florida have the highest incarceration rate of any state in the country?
I don't know that. That's a good question. I will admit my ignorance on that one.
But it does have a reputation for a lot of prisoner abuse.
Yeah, I think it does. And I can say anecdotally that I know a lot of clients who fit that bill.
What is your practice like? I mean, you're a criminal defense attorney. What are mostly drug cases or what?
You know, I try to stick with drug cases. I mean, I've done the gamut. You know, I've done everything from petty theft to grand theft to murder to armed robbery. I mean, I've done everything, but I try to stick with drug trafficking and drug offenses because that's what I really care about, because I'm very much against the drug war, and I don't care whether my client did it or not. They should not be charged with a crime in my eyes if it's just the drugs. So those are the cases I try to stick with. But, I mean, realistically, to keep the doors open, you got to take a bunch of cases. And so, you know, I'll take the bigger cases when they come in.
So about corporate interest controlling a government, what are your thoughts on that Supreme Court decision? I forget the specific name of the decision off the top of my head.
Talking about Citizens United?
Yes,
Citizens United.
The Supreme Court said that corporate donations and unlimited donations are protected under the First Amendment.
Right. Well, this might be another unsatisfying answer where I'm walking a tightrope, but I used to be very much against Citizens United, and I personally don't think that corporations should have unlimited power to donate. You know, the way we hear about the case, I'm in agreement that Citizens United should be overturned. However, I mentioned Christopher Cantwell earlier on. When I talked to him about this, he was pointing out that the background of this story is that a conservative organization had made a documentary attacking Hillary Clinton, and that was the controversy. So the liberals don't like Citizens United because, you know, it allows for corporations to attack their candidate. It upholds that. And so I, at this point, I don't know what to think, but as a principle, I think that corporations should not be allowed to lobby in the way they are. I think that politicians should not be allowed to gain million-dollar salaries once they get out of office by joining companies that they have helped pass their legislation for years while they were legislators. I think that's just morally wrong. It's against your civic duty to do something like that.
What are your thoughts on some of the trade deals, like the current one, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the other ones like NAFTA?
I'm really not in favor of those kind of deals. I'm not in favor of the – I think there's a – man, I mean, that's a big question. There is a lot of sentiment that we should have absolutely free trade and that there should be no borders to trade or anything like that. But I think, you know, that would hurt us, at least small businesses. I think a bright line – policy that I would follow is if it helps small businesses, that's what I would favor. And if it looks like crony capitalism, as we call it, if it looks like it's a policy that favors big corporations, that's what I would be against. I'm pretty much across the board.
I was listening to the Republican debate, and I was listening to both Donald Trump, who's made this a big issue, and Rand Paul. And Rand Paul's response was that we could bring back jobs from overseas with free trade if we had more of a free market economy and lower taxes. But I just don't buy that argument from Rand Paul, because there's no way we can compete with these countries that basically have large
right.
amounts of slave labor.
Yeah, right. When you're paying somebody 50 cents a day to work in your factories, how could any city in America compete with that?
Well, I mean, they're doing exactly the opposite. They're making it completely impossible. I mean, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Right. Exactly.
Why don't we just start bombing our own cities right now? seriously, I mean, we couldn't do anything more destructive to our own economy. If the goal is economic suicide, let's just price ourselves out of the world market and make sure that everything is produced and almost everything is consumed in other countries.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what we're aiming for. And you got to think, the bleeding heart liberals that want this slave labor to end overseas, they're the same ones saying, well, we should have a living wage here in America and we should force business owners to pay $15 an hour. I mean, what do you think is going to happen when you start charging $15 an hour for, you know, sweeping floors and working in fast food? I mean, people are going to be unemployed at an unprecedented rate.
I think so. I mean, I can't believe that people are so enthusiastic about it, and that people are just dumb. I mean, I don't know if this is a result of dysgenics you're talking about, excessive welfare,
right.
or what, but, you know, the only entity that can... the only entity that can afford to do this is the entity that prints money, and that means the government, basically.
Yeah, well, I think of a lot of those kids pushing the $15 an hour thing. I just don't think they're looking at the big picture. I think they're looking, like they say, if you're a conservative before you're 30, then you don't have a heart. And if you're a liberal after you're 30, then you don't have a brain. And I think a lot of people just... They think, well, if we just give everyone $15 an hour, I mean, everybody can live and life would be wonderful. But they don't think it's bigger picture.
What you're feeding is inflation. I mean, what you're feeding is just you're promoting the endless cycle of inflation
right.
and the complete debasement of our economy. And I am at a loss to understand why so many conservatives, I don't know how you feel about Trump, but I'm at a loss to see why he's so popular with conservatives, because he seems to have completely embraced inflationary banking mentality. Do you,
right.
do you disagree with that?
Are we talking about Trump?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, yeah. There are a lot of things that, you know, I love Donald Trump. I really do. I'm a fan since I read Bret Easton Ellis' American Psycho, and he was Patrick Bateman's idol. I mean, Trump's a great guy as far as style goes. I mean, I love the guy. But there are some policies he holds that are just, they're antithetical to the welfare of America, and I think that's one of them. You know, anyone who supports the Federal Reserve doing whatever they want and inflating the money and just destroying the economy, I don't know how to support that, and I don't know how you rationalize that other than it keeps the rich rich and the poor poor, at least until it collapses.
You brought up the issue earlier of usury, and could you explain your views on usury more in detail?
Well, yeah, this will probably earn me some heat, but I'm
picking all the right questions to get you into trouble.
Yeah, you're just trying to sink this campaign, aren't you, man? No, I'm a very ancient soul. I have a very ancient world outlook, and I think a lot of it has to do with romanticism, maybe, or maybe I'm just stuck in the medievalism. I don't know, but it used to be that interest was not allowed in civilized society. It used to be an evil. If you loaned money to someone, you got back what you loaned them. This, 23% APR or $200,000 in student loans when you only had $150,000, it's just, it's immoral. And I am personally against
about
speculation like that.
I'm curious about something. You are basically reciting the position of the Roman Catholic Church, really up through about 1500 AD. But you have left Christianity. Is that true? Is that part of it?
That is. Yeah. I have not been a Christian since I was 13 years old. But that doesn't mean that the Catholic Church is wrong about everything. I think there are certain moral principles that pagans, atheists, Muslims, and Catholics share, and one of those is not believing in usury. Well, maybe not the atheists so much, but the rest of us, it is immoral for someone to scalp another man because he has loaned him money. That seems to be common fare here in America, and I disagree with that personally.
Notice with your name, Augustus Invictus, and the symbol you use ancient Roman symbolism. You have, like, the laurel wreath. What is the importance of ancient Rome and the symbols of the Roman Senate to you?
It's part of how he gets confused as a fascist. He's using the fasces.
Right. And a lot of people don't realize that the fasces, it comes from ancient Rome. It is not Mussolini's symbol. He adopted that symbol. And so did our founding fathers. But to answer your question, I was given my name in a religious initiation. I didn't choose it, but still, I've been raised with an appreciation for Greco-Roman culture. My dad, he gave me an option of whether to go into the law program or the ROTC when I got to high school. But the one thing that was beyond discussion was I was going to take Latin. There was nothing to discuss there. So I took 3 years of Latin, and I've had an appreciation of it since boyhood. The Roman Senate, however, was the historical antecedent to our own Senate. And our government is very much based on the Roman Republic. And what I've been trying to do with the imagery, some of the symbolism of the campaign, is to resurrect those roots and to go back to what our founding fathers intended. They did not intend a mass democracy. They intended a republic. And that's something we've lost sight of. So I'd like to get that back in the minds of Americans.
I was just going to say, it's so fascinating. I mean, the Roman Empire, I'm very interested. You say a lot of things that sound very solidly conservative in some ways, but I mean, how do you reconcile having rejected Christianity with conservatism? I mean, tell me a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I never thought of myself as a conservative. You know, I never, when I first heard myself called a right-wing politician, I didn't know what to think. I mean, I'm the one that's telling people you should try LSD, you know, and go to a strip club. I've to be called right-wing was fascinating to me, but I do agree with a lot of traditionalist policies, and I do harken back to roots. And you know, I was raised a white American, and I was raised in the South, and everything that comes along with, that's me. That my paganism, I've always considered that just part of my life. I think paganism is largely conservative in many ways, especially when you look to heathen culture or Odinist, you know, the Northern European tradition. They're very much conservative. My personal sect of Thelema is not conservative. It's very transgressive, but still, as far as society goes, I think that there's a lot to be said for traditionalism.
Well, now, Thelema is basically the religion of Aleister Crowley, who's also considered the founder of modern Wicca, isn't he?
Well, his student, Gerald Gardner, was the founder of Wicca, and Gerald Gardner had a lot of unkind things say about Crowley while simultaneously plagiarizing from him. So they're different people with a common lineage.
Can you talk about your you have this post on LinkedIn, a call for a total resurrection, talk about a lot of different things. You talk about LSD, you talk about
right
taking your girlfriend to a strip club and worshiping nature and a lot of different stuff.
Right, that's what I was referring to when I was saying that. That was the call for total insurrection was saying that what I was making earlier, that point about this is a cultural movement. And I think that's the speech where I first said, if you think electing someone to office is going to change the world, you're crazy. Because it's a cultural thing. And I think the point of that speech was to say you need to break your personal boundaries, you need to reject the system and just forget everything you know about politics, about society, and really look inside of yourself and think about why you are in politics and think about what you want to change in the world, and do it without looking at Twitter and watching CNN. I mean, really break your boundaries and think about these things. So I think part of that does include transgressive things like the strip club and nature worship and all of those other things.
The root of the problem is not so much the government itself, but it's this culture that forces everyone to kind of conform to these norms. It suppresses free-spirited individuals.
No, actually, I think that the problem is deeper than that. I think that it's not so much a social problem or a governmental problem. It is a human problem. It is human nature that we are conformist, and it is human nature that we bow down to the government. And I think that the role of all leaders should be to raise people up and say, no, you should not be on your knees. You should be standing, free man. That's what I'm trying to get across. I'm trying to tell people, look in the mirror. Ask yourself whether you were part of the problem, because that's the real question you should be asking. Not, you know, should we have no government or a monarchy or a democracy? The question is, who are you as a human being? What is your worth? What is your dignity? And are you going to suffer the indignities that the present government is forcing upon you?
And I agree completely. I think the problem is that most people are conformists. I don't know if it's genetic or not, it probably is, but most people are conformists and they're looking for someone to follow, and that's the key problem with mass democracy is leaders can easily exploit the conformist masses.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that. I mean, and even in my own campaign, I have to think sometimes, you know, I get commended a lot for speaking the truth, but I have to constantly reevaluate that and say, what am I doing? You know, or am I leading people who are simply conforming to what I've said? Or, you know, am I giving the wrong message to people? Because it's very true that supporters or fans or whatever you want to call them, voters, they may not be thinking and they may not be listening to what you're really saying. They're just looking for a leader who's not all the other leaders. So it's something to constantly reflect upon.
You know, there's so many things going on. Robert originally asked me, you know, like 45 minutes before this program to come on, because he said that you were a Confederate sympathizer, and you're talking about a second Civil War, and I'm just wondering, you don't sound much like a Confederate to me.
With the Yankee accent or the
personal outlook. You're not what I would call a social conservative in any sense. It doesn't sound like most Confederates tend to be fairly socially conservative and Christian too. I mean,
that's true.
But you, what is your position on the heritage of the South and the identity of the South and you know, the possibility? You're talking about insurrection, but I mean, you're running for Senate. Are you interested in the possibility of secession? I mean, do any of these Confederate notions come into your thinking at all?
Right. Well, I think the fastest way to start a civil war in this country is clearly to attempt secession. So, you know, there's that to be said. As far as my own outlook on the Civil War, I don't think it's going to be North-South again, and I don't think it's necessarily going to be any states against states or even states against the federal government. I think that if war breaks out now, we're so balkanized that it's going to be a war of all against all, and people are going to have to choose what banner they're under, whether it's Christian or Muslim or Yankee or Southerner or Westerner or whatever. Everybody's going to have to choose their own side. So I'm not trying to, you know, evoke the first Civil War in those statements. But as far as my outlook on Southern heritage, and I was raised in the South. I consider myself a Southerner, and I didn't really awaken to that fact until I went to law school in Chicago. I think that's where I really noticed what the difference was. The way culture in the North is just not the same as it is down here. Manners are different. Mannerisms are different. There's still a very old divide where they think we're slow. They think that we're a little backwoods or backwater.
Where in the South are you from? Because you don't have a strong Southern accent. Huh?
I am from Florida. So I was born in Ohio, but I moved down here when I was 3.
Okay. So,
yeah,
were you from Southern Ohio or Northern Ohio?
I was born in Kettering, which is outside of Dayton, but my father was a Kentucky man, and my mother's family's from the Carolinas. He was only there because of law school. So I was born while my father was in law school, so that's why I was born there. He went to Ohio State University, the Buckeyes.
So I want to ask you about your views on foreign policy, because obviously we've gone through a lot of disastrous wars. We've had the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Clinton did in Serbia, what Obama did in removing Gaddafi in Libya, creating this current disaster in Europe. Right now, the government is instigating in Syria and provoking a conflict with Russia. I mean, we have such a horrible policy. Obviously, you're against all that stuff, but what do you see as some of the main driving forces behind our foreign policy, and what can you do in the Senate to end that?
Oh, man. That's probably the best foreign policy question I've ever been asked, man. Thank you. I think the driving force behind this is our total rejection of colonialism after the Second World War. I think that's been the driving force behind a lot of our foreign policy for the past couple generations. If you look to what the British Empire did, they would go in, you know, topple whoever they want, kill whatever. That's what we do anyway, but when they did that, when they would take control of a territory, they took it upon themselves to institute government. And it was their mission to spread culture and to take responsibility for that. The American foreign policy has been historically, especially since the Second World War, to go in, topple whoever they want, and just allow American corporations to go in and rape the country. They don't institute real government. They don't institute a real legal system. We seem to think that as long as, you know, corporations are free to do whatever they want, we have no real responsibility there. And it's their problem, you know. Well, Saddam Hussein's gone, and, you know, have a blast. Just don't do anything that would jeopardize McDonald's interests. That is probably what I see as the main failing of American foreign policy, is the failure to take responsibility for what we've done. Now, I do personally think that I'd like to implement a non-interventionist foreign policy. I'm not a pacifist, but I don't think it's America's job to be policing the world. On the other hand, if you're going to go into a place like Iraq, or if you're going to send special forces to Syria or Afghanistan, if you're going to do that, then go in to win. You don't go in to screw around and just play there for 10 years. You go in with an objective. And I think that's something that American foreign policy has also been lacking, is the will to win, or even the strategy or the desire to win. We just go in there saying, well, we're going to kick the can around a little and not have an exit strategy, and the whole thing is a cluster. So that is the second thing that I would implement as center, or at least attempt to convince everyone else to implement.
Do you have anybody else in Florida who's running with you comrades in arms?
I know some local politicians who support me, but they're not libertarians, and they're not running for federal office. So realistically speaking, no, I do not have anyone that I could form a band with, so to speak.
Are you looking for anybody?
So, am I looking for anyone? Sure. Yeah, I mean, if other people wanted to run for, you know, any office, U.S. House or anything like that, then we could do speeches together.
How does the system in Florida work? Are you, since you're the only Libertarian candidate, is there a primary in Florida, and you're going to be automatically the nominee, or are you guaranteed ballot access in any sense? How does that work?
No, if they recruit someone to run against me, then I will have a primary. If Roger Stone enters the race, then there will be a primary. If not, you know, if we go another, 9 or 10 months, and no one else has the money or the will to jump into this race and get on the ballot, then I will be the only one. There will be no need for a primary, and I will go to the general election.
Okay, but when you say you have no support from the Libertarian Party, they have not even paid your filing fee. You had to pay your own filing fee.
Yeah, no, the Libertarian Party of Florida will not help me officially in any capacity. However, there are many members of the Libertarian Party of Florida who do support me and who actively are involved in the campaign. It's just the leadership, they've taken this hardline stance against me, and they've even condemned me to the media. So I don't expect any support from them, certainly not even helping with the filing fee.
What about these major sort of establishment Libertarian organizations like Reason Magazine and the Cato Institute? How have they covered your campaign? Have they been supportive or critical?
As far as I know, the Cato Institute has not written anything about my campaign. Reason has, but it focused on that whole scandal with the goat sacrifice. So I wouldn't call it sympathetic or supportive. However, we do have people on the campaign team who have spoken with the people at Reason, and it could be that in the near future we might have another shot at that. But Cato, again, no, I haven't heard anything from the Cato Institute.
You actually traveled all the way to the desert in Mojave Desert in California to do that. Were you on – what was your mode of transportation? Did you bicycle or walk?
No, I walked. I walked from Orlando to the Mojave. But I didn't walk every step of the way. I mean, there were people who were pulling over to help, you know, give me food, give me rides, anything. There are people who are very helpful. So I made it over there to the Mojave in a matter of weeks. I did not walk the whole way, that's for sure.
Was it the California side of the Mojave?
Yeah, it was right past Needles, California.
Okay, I know where that is.
Yeah, it's like hell on earth there. It's not the pretty part of the Mojave.
We are getting out of, we are basically out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our audience about your campaign and about yourself? Give out a message to everyone who's listening.
Yeah, my campaign team always slaps me after interviews for not doing the obligatory political thing. I got to say, you know, go to InvictusForSenate.com and please make a donation. You can buy T-shirts and all that stuff. That's all I'm required to say. But otherwise, man, I think we've covered a lot of ground. But thank you very much for having me on, man. And thank you very much, especially for the foreign policy question.
I'll have your campaign website linked on my website. So thanks, Augustus Evictus, for being on.
Sure. No, thanks for having me, man.
And thanks, Charles, for being joining me again as a co-host.
It has been quite interesting, quite enlightening, and one of the most amazing characters you've had on your show. It is a pleasure to meet you, sir. And you know, I hope that we'll have an opportunity to talk to you real soon again.
Yes, sir. I would like that.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.